not going to grace
without her presence today.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a group.
Yeah, just to let you know, this is not
okay. Yeah, but she is not following.
Okay, just so she knows she's not here.
That's not the issue. I have the.
The issue is that I get rid of this, right?
Yeah, you get rid of this, but.
At least for you. I mean, if the other country wants to keep it, let them keep it. I don't know what this is.
So we have only two speakers, you said, in the morning?
And, no, no, three and two, five. SAO and UNDP. UNDP two.
And they will be answering the questions.
So
we simply have to.
Look at this. How is this?
No, I've seen it. I've seen it, but I'm just thinking how it's going to work.
This item six, you see, questions, comments for UNDP, the indigenous. Then questions, comments to SAO. And this afternoon, questions, comments to all.
Yes, because I have to write the summary.
So this is important. And where are my friendship documents?
Yes.
Yeah, just one minor issue, which is that clearly should be starting a dialogue with the agencies now. FAO insisted very much strongly on them need to do a farm report. So I have to scramble in.
Hello. Ms. Roberts.
And Tim Rollison here, Secretary.
Who's here?
Hi.
Hi, nice
to meet you. Hi. I'm not here for UNDP.
Yes.
Should I mention you? You're not part of that.
Вот по списку тогда, по этому списку.
Вот который у меня там Лидия Слава, наверное.
Да.
Вот. Поэтому нас нужно не
списать. Не Лидия, там поставили. Ну,
just to keep it short, technicians will be here as well.
So they will have a talk presentation.
So FAO have their presentation on the computer here
at 12 o'clock.
At 12 o'clock, when UNDP finished, FAO come in. So there is a switch and then all that. So it'll be a little disruptive. The screen comes down.
Rebecca Greenstone.
So we should be okay. I just wanted to let you know, you should know about this, yeah. The only problem is that the people that are behind there won't see.
Yeah.
I told them that, but, and I asked them to make copies, to distribute copies to
why
people.
Why do they need this?
I have a... I know.
Boom.
I could not agree with them.
Hello, sorry. I just have a question about the statement by the SR.
It will, actually, yes.
Do you know what that is?
If it hasn't been done so already, then in the next day or two.
Okay.
Yeah. And almost certainly, I don't know, you should also check the his page on the commission. It's not there yet. Okay, yeah.
He doesn't publish statements on the document.
Okay, yeah, we will do that. At the latest, it'll be after the weekend. But hopefully, if we're all here instead of in our office, we'll be able to do that. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. I don't know. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah, maybe next week. You just give to me, give to us first, and yes, you can disseminate it. Good morning, everybody. Can I ask everybody to please take their seats? Our colleagues are all here now from the UNDP. So take your seats, and we'll start in 1 minute. Good morning. The eighth meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, today, as part of our new methods of work under Agenda Item 6, the forum will hold an in-depth comprehensive dialogue with the six United Nations agencies and funds, such as the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Fund for Development, United Nations Development Programme, and the United Nations Population Fund, and the Department of Economic and Social Affairs of the UN Secretariat. I would like first to give you a briefing of how we are intending to move this before I call on our distinguished representatives. First of all, we would like to suggest that the in-depth dialogue process should be conducted as follows. First, we listen to the introduction by the agency concerned, and we will allot 15 to 20 minutes for this. Secondly, we will ask the focal person or persons assigned under the specific agencies to ask the questions, and this will be approximately 15 minutes or less. Thirdly, after the questions have been asked, we will ask the agencies to respond, and this will take around 25 minutes. Then fourth, we will open the floor for questions from delegations and Indigenous Peoples organizations, and this will be approximately 15 minutes. In this agenda, in this part, I would like you to really just ask questions, not make long statements, because otherwise we cannot ask them to make the responses to the questions that you have raised. So I know that many of you have made statements, but I'm urging you to just really go to the questions immediately as a brief as you can, so that we can really get the dialogue going. And then after the questions have been raised, we will ask again the agencies to respond. This will take approximately 25 minutes, and we will have concluding comments and observations by the members of the permanent forum for the last 20 minutes. For each agency, we are allotting only 2 hours, so that's why I request you not to really read your statements and just go to the questions you would need to ask. So with that, I would like to take this opportunity to extend a warm welcome to the following distinguished representatives of these agencies, Mr. Ad Melkert, the Associate Administrator of UNDP, and Ms. Rebecca Greenspan, the Director of the Regional Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean. And yeah, these are the two people who will be here, and they have a full staff who are the other senior management people and other personnel who will be here to also provide the answers if they need to. So without further ado, I would like to invite Mr. Ad Melkert to please take the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, distinguished representatives of indigenous peoples throughout the world. It's with great honor that I address the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues today. And let me also say how much I welcome your initiative to have this very interactive opportunity for you, but also for us, to learn and to act upon what we learned today. And this is our commitment being with you this morning. Since its inaugural session in 2001, the Permanent Forum has been an indispensable venue for the advancement of justice, peace, and dignity for indigenous peoples. The forum facilitated the historic adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and continues to raise awareness and provide advice to the programs, funds, and agencies of the United Nations. Your permanent forum reminds us that the UN is much more than just the sum of its member states. We the peoples is a promise, and that promise extends beyond the nation state. The participation of indigenous peoples in dialogues in and beyond this forum helps the United Nations realize the depth of this promise and the enrichment that is possible in pursuit of its fulfillment. The United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, is honoured to work in close collaboration with indigenous communities, and its vision of sustainable human development is continually enhanced by our collaborative work. Indeed, commitment to intergenerational equity and environmental balance are common threads that bind UNDP to indigenous peoples across the world. As the international community mobilizes the collective will to tackle the multiple crises we face in poverty, food, economy, climate change, and conflict, and as we continue work towards achievement of the Millennium Development Goals, indigenous peoples offer a valued range of perspectives and are uniquely positioned to offer innovative solutions. I'm here today to say that UNDP is committed to listening. Solutions to these crises will not be effectively forged without the full and active participation and input of indigenous communities. With this in mind, I'm also here to affirm that UNDP is committed to creating space at the local, regional, national, and international level to ensure that local and indigenous voices are heard, that they inform policy making, and that they are acted upon. A central area of our work is environment and energy, where indigenous peoples possess key traditional knowledge and expertise. Though hardly recognized, indigenous peoples and local actors are the chief users and guardians of the world's ecosystems, managing or administering at least 22% of developing country forests and employing diverse landscape management approaches in over half the world's 102,000 protected areas. Through generations and over hundreds of years, indigenous peoples have successfully used traditional ecological knowledge to manage natural resources, conserve and maintain ecosystems, alleviate poverty, secure adequate supply of food, water, and energy, and adapt to environmental changes. Too often, though, indigenous peoples are excluded from meaningful participation in environment and energy policy-making processes and programs. Such exclusion has served to weaken the impact, cost-effectiveness, and sustainability of initiatives, of funding mechanisms, and of programs implemented by national governments and international development agencies. And we are committed to reversing this trend and working through a number of programs to empower and support local and indigenous initiatives. Let me mention here the UNDP GF Small Grants Program that has funded over 10,000 projects, locally initiated and managed in collaborations with NGOs, CBOs, and indigenous groups in 120 countries. Approximately 15% of the funding portfolio goes to projects submitted by indigenous peoples' organizations. Significant efforts have been exerted to increase the use of innovative formats for the submission of project concepts, such as through the use of participatory video. For instance, the Baka people in eastern Cameroon are using video cameras with support from UNDP to document how climate change is damaging the forests where they live. The Small Grants Program is also implementing a community-based adaptation to climate change initiative to pilot local-level climate risk management projects. UNDP is currently supporting the development of 80 to 200 community-driven climate change risk management projects in 10 countries. For instance, in Guatemala, projects under development in the Quiché and Mam communities are focusing on reducing the increasing risks of landslides and soil erosion in the highland agro-ecosystems. We also have actively engaged in the so-called Equator Initiative, a cross-sector partnership that develops the capacity and raises the profile of grassroots efforts to reduce poverty through the conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity. The Equator Initiative has helped more than 1,400 community-based natural resource management initiatives raise their profile, link with technical and business support, and connect with their peers to share best practices. Close to 50% of Equator Prize recipients have been indigenous peoples from across the tropics. To name just a few from the prize in 2008, the Yawanawa Agro-Extractive Cooperative from Brazil, the Chalalan Ecolodge from Bolivia, and the Union of Farming and Indigenous Organizations of Cotacachi from Ecuador. The UN RED program, aiming to contribute to the development of capacity for reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, is a collaborative effort between UNDP, the UN Environment Programme, and the Food and Agriculture Organization that also supports the international dialogue for the inclusion of a RED mechanism in a post-2012 climate regime. UN RED is investing substantial energy to ensure that indigenous peoples are included as key stakeholders in the process, and that the RED mechanism benefits and empowers local and indigenous communities. UNDP has played a lead role developing the so-called operational guidance on the engagement of indigenous peoples and other forest communities, which will be presented at a consultation side event on Wednesday next week. Throughout these and other initiatives, the promotion of gender equality and empowerment of indigenous women remains crucial. To offer just a few examples, we are supporting the government of Namibia to enhance legal protection of San women against gender-based violence and improving their access to the prevention and treatment of HIV/AIDS. The UNDP Regional Programme on Indigenous Peoples' Rights and Development in Asia is training indigenous women on decision-making to address the power dynamics that exist in their communities. For instance, in Bangladesh, we have helped set up 450 women's groups, empowering and allowing them to develop their own community-based projects and setting up a grassroots leaders network. In the area of democratic governance, I should mention the Interparliamentary Union and UNDP initiative that is working to promote the effective representation of indigenous peoples in parliaments. In Burundi, UNDP has provided support to the associations of Batwas to develop small and medium-sized enterprise projects for income generation. All of this is inspired by the historic UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This declaration guides our engagement with indigenous peoples. We are fully committed to implementing the UN Development Group guidelines on the indigenous peoples' issues, agreed last February 2008, and supporting program country governments in the identification and formulation of more targeted initiatives, together with promoting policies for the integration of indigenous rights in programmatic interventions, including the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. Not only do indigenous peoples often belong to the most marginalized populations in society, being disproportionately represented among those at risk of not achieving the MDGs. In too many instances, they continue to be worst affected by development projects that are not sensitive to their unique situations and needs. In this second international decade of indigenous peoples, and in the context of the UN Declaration, we need to match words with decisive action. To this aim, and in the spirit of delivering as one UN, UNDP, the International Labour Organization, and the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights are jointly exploring the possibility of establishing a global Indigenous Peoples Partnership, which would, through participatory mechanisms, offer a framework to support programme country governments in strengthening national capacities towards the implementation of legal standards contained in the Declaration and the ILO Convention 169. We welcome that the theme of the Permanent Forum for next year is development with culture and identity. We hope to work closely with you and the UN Interagency Support Group to the Permanent Forum in this dialogue. The year 2010 marks a number of key milestones in international development. It is the 20th anniversary of the launch of the UNDP Human Development Report. It is the 10-year review of the Millennium Declaration and the Millennium Development Goals. And it is 15 years after the big conference of Beijing on the position and equal rights of women. So once again, I look forward to greater engagement and partnership, and UNDP will continue to play an instrumental role in ensuring that your voices are heard loudly and clearly and contribute to local, national, and global human development. Thank you very much.
I'd like to warmly thank Mr. Ad Melkert, the Associate Administrator of UNDP. Thank you very much, sir. And I call on Ms. Rebecca Greenspan, the Director of the Regional Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean. You have the floor, madam.
I will address the forum in Spanish. Estimada Doña Victoria Tauli Corpus, Presidenta del Foro, estimado Melker, estimados compañeros de la mesa, distinguidos representantes de los pueblos indígenas y miembros expertos del Foro Permanente de Asuntos Indígenas y representantes de los fondos y programas y del Secretariado de las Naciones Unidas.
Just a second. There's no translation. Is the Spanish translator in the booth? Can the Spanish translator speak out? Are you there in the booth? Yes? Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah? Sorry for that. Yes.
Okay. La dirección.
The Regional Directorate for Latin America and the Caribbean of UNDP fully recognizes the rights of the indigenous peoples to full development of the human being. Furthermore, it's well aware of the special situation of discrimination, marginalization, and poverty faced in the region, which we've tried to document, and I'd like to give you an idea of some of the publications we have here. We also recognize not only the question of marginalization and poverty, but also the lack of knowledge of the great contribution which indigenous peoples make to the cultures of Latin America and the Caribbean. We understand that this situation impedes them from full exercise of their human rights and full exercise of their citizenship. In the context of the Regional Cooperation Program of UNDP for Latin America and the Caribbean for the period 2008-2011, we highlight the high degree of inequality which exists in the region and the fact that the information providing average percentages continue to conceal the situation of groups of society which are in positions of special vulnerability and exclusion, especially women, children, youngsters, those of African origin, indigenous peoples, and individuals living with disabilities. We've said that in Latin America, we need to overcome the tyranny of averages in order to find what the real situation is of some of the people concealed behind those figures. And in this context, we feel it's necessary to have inclusive participation for democratic governance in progress of human rights for the whole population, and increasingly urgently for groups such as indigenous peoples. This is a fundamental task in the context of regional cooperation of UNDP with a view to achieving the Millennium Development Goals. Within the human rights approach, the UNDP has taken the lead in the work with indigenous peoples in the region, especially through projects under the HURIS program, implemented in conjunction with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, spanning countries with a high percentage of indigenous populations, such as Guatemala, Ecuador, and Bolivia. In addition to a number of specific studies and innovative publications of general dissemination on the rights of indigenous peoples and direct training for country teams, this program, HURIST, facilitated the creation or strengthening of interagency working groups on interculturality, which has already promoted the inclusion of the intercultural approach in a number of assistance frameworks. Furthermore, this program made it possible to establish in December of 2006 in Bolivia establishment of a National Council for Dialogue for Indigenous Peoples. This council has made it possible to have consultations among indigenous representatives, government officials, and delegates from UN agencies. And we've now updated this mechanism and tried to have similar consultation mechanisms in other countries of the region. At the global level, as an example of a regional program which has proved to be successful, there is the Regional Initiative for Asia and the Pacific on the Rights and Development of Indigenous Peoples, which is known as RIP, and it's carried out in 10 countries, and it's concluded the first phase of its activities, and it's recognized as unique within the UN system. Along the same lines of this program, and in keeping with the recommendations of the Permanent Forum on consultations, participation, dissemination, and implementation of the rights of indigenous peoples, and more specifically, in keeping with the recommendation to establish similar programs to RIP in other regions of the world, as of March of this year, as part and parcel of the Comprehensive Human Rights Strengthening Program, according to which significant participation is a key component of the human rights-based approach, UNDP launched the Indigenous Initiative, which plans to make systematic the best practices brought about in work with indigenous peoples in Latin America, as well as organizing a number of national workshops with indigenous peoples organizations with three objectives. The first, to increase dissemination of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Second, to build capacity for analysis and development of projects and programs which guarantee a rights-based approach. And thirdly, to secure recommendations in order to facilitate participation of indigenous peoples in development programs and processes. With this initiative, we hope to be able to develop in a near future, in an agreed participatory fashion, a true regional program in Latin America and the Caribbean. Together with this regional initiative, on the basis of the specific policy of UNDP for these populations, as Agnès already said, and in a more focused fashion in recent years, using the action plan to implement UN guidelines on indigenous peoples approved in 2007 in the context of the second international decade of indigenous peoples of the world, in most of the countries of Latin America, we are implementing an array of programs and projects with the indigenous peoples in various fields. And here I'd like to say that this has also been a learning process for us, acknowledging that it's not always been with the indigenous peoples. Very often it's been on top of, over the indigenous peoples. Now there's been a fundamental paradigm shift in which we're changing our methods to ensure that the indigenous peoples are not the object of policies and programs, but the subject, the driving force behind these programs and projects, as is their right. And they now need to be active and decisive players in developing these programs. In some programs, we've developed a number of corrective activities to an approach which did not always fulfill that principle. The principle of opening up areas of dialogue at the national and regional level so that indigenous peoples are not objects but subjects, instigators of their own development. And these are a part and parcel of the policies and programs and best practices we're working on. But now I'd like to move to some of the activities and programs which we have in the region, in the field of economic and social development. We're implementing innovative projects such as Eficacia in Paraguay to buttress the economy of traditional reciprocity, as it's called, or Hopoi in their language. It's also been successful experience in the environment for some years now with programs such as Small Donations, which incorporate local councils of indigenous peoples in the whole development process. And more recently, the conservation of indigenous territories on the basis of their cultural specificities, including those which are superimposed on protected areas, as is the case in Colombia, Ecuador, and Paraguay. In the field of education, it's a pioneering field of cooperation for respect and promotion of the cultural assets of our societies. In regions such as Central America, we're continuing to make progress through the intercultural multilingual education program, for example. And in the field of health, we should highlight initiatives such as the integrated program for improving maternal mortality indices in Honduras, with special attention paid to indigenous women, as well as assistance for improving the health and nutrition conditions in various indigenous communities of Colombia and Argentina. We continue to make progress in better understanding and better incorporating the values, practices, as well as the institutions of these populations for their well-being and for the population in general, in terms of valuing their cultural diversity as a value in itself, while also seeing it as a resource to improve better, to improve living standards and lead to better coexistence. Mediation and capacity building are increasingly being called upon in UNDP by states and indigenous organizations. We're also providing advice and opportunities for dialogue in the process of achieving, in an agreed fashion, new constitutional frameworks and ensuring secondary legislation in Ecuador and Bolivia, for example, supporting increasingly citizens' participation in Peru and Venezuela, together with the development and implementation of inclusive policies of an intercultural nature, as in Brazil, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, as well as trying to manage local and national political crises, essentially the cases of Colombia and Paraguay. In terms of cross-cutting support of UNDP, this can be very complex. In Mexico, we're moving towards gender equality and full exercise of human rights of indigenous peoples through projects such as the strengthening of democratic culture in the various indigenous electoral districts. There's been a major effort to break down our statistics, highlighting the gaps and inequalities which exist in the country. The main purpose of this program in Mexico was to foster political participation of the indigenous population, especially women. And one of the main outputs was the development of a study on political participation and the leadership of indigenous women. Likewise, there have been consultative councils for sustainable development developed by the Ministry for the Environment in Mexico. In Ecuador and Bolivia, in keeping with the new constitutional frameworks, we're developing with the state their respective programs for making progress on public policies. And in Nicaragua, we should highlight projects directly related to the requirements of indigenous populations, such as support for the strengthening of the territorial and communal governments of the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua for autonomous public management and the promotion of the rights of indigenous peoples in 25 indigenous territories and territories where the population are of African descent, and giving demarcation and empowerment to those territories. In Paraguay, we've been developing activities for advocacy through strengthening fora for dialogue in the construction of public policies, through the Ayoreo Todo Biagosode Interinstitutional Office. And we've also provided support for the Coordinator for Self-Determination of Indigenous Peoples, known as CAPI, in building up a proposal for public policies for indigenous populations to be presented to the government as a basis for discussion and tackling the indigenous issues in Paraguay. And I wouldn't want to conclude without referring to the case of Guatemala with the implementation of the Firm and Lasting Peace Agreement, which we continue to support, and there are the so-called development councils, which have been developed in order to incorporate the voice of the indigenous peoples. And there are continuing initiatives such as the Maya program for the exercise of the rights of indigenous peoples and the Chumilal Hub, justice, harmony, and well-being. In Guatemala as well, there's a very innovative program being developed with young people, Mayan youngsters, which is just about to begin in partnership with the Maya organizations of the region. And it's already engendered great enthusiasm. In Peru, we've made progress on projects such as the Ombudsman and follow-up to recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In the context of the recent approval of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, an effort has been made, a major effort has been made, with the team of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the UN Population Fund in an interagency effort to produce workshops in order to make better known the Declaration. And those workshops, I should say, are not just for those outside the United Nations, it's also for the UN offices themselves, because part of the problem is raising awareness and of and training our own country offices so that they can better implement the recommendation. And we've reproduced this in formats and languages of indigenous peoples in Mexico, Ecuador, and Paraguay, producing this declaration in the languages. And we've also had a number of seminars. There's one in Central America. There's already been one in Lima, for the South American region, in which UNDP was very actively involved. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the work of the advisory group of UNICEF, which is crucial in the interagency regional consultative group of indigenous leaders. And we're developing a new forum here in order to make possible processes for consultation and participation with the involvement of the indigenous organizations and in order to build capacity therein. There's a long way to go yet in achieving the goals of the declaration. We need to step up our efforts, bolster our work, but I repeat that our starting point, the associate administrator referred to this, the point that we still have a lot to do, and it's with the countries. And you in your countries, that we can move forward in a collective and intercultural fashion for the common good. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rebecca Greenspan, for that contribution in relation to the work done by the UNDP in the Latin America and Caribbean region. At this point, I'd like to call on my distinguished colleague, Mr. Eugenio Insigne, to read out the questions that we have consolidated from our own, from the various members of the forum, as well as from some indigenous organizations which have submitted their questions to us. You have the floor, Mr. Insigne.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, UNDP. There are a lot of questions that have been forwarded to us. I am just going to read all of them and leave it to the UNDP to decide which questions to answer now and which questions will be the subject of a written reply in the future. These are the questions. One, role of UNDP in light of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In the light of the adoption of the Declaration and the obligations of all UN agencies under Articles 41 and 42, how has this impacted on the work of the UNDP? Number two, in your view, what is the niche of the UNDP in the area of indigenous peoples' issues and promoting the rights of indigenous peoples? On policies and procedures, A, how do you foresee the declaration impacting UNDP policies and procedures, particularly the principles of free, prior, and informed consent and need for consultative and participatory mechanisms at the national and local levels? B, how does UNDP secure the implementation of free, prior, and informed consent with partners at the local and national levels. What are some of the main challenges and opportunities in the implementation of free, prior, and informed consent? C. How is the UNDP promoting and implementing the UNDG guidelines on indigenous people's issues? D. How are indigenous peoples included in UNDP's strategic plan for 2008 up to 2011? E. With regards to the UNDP policy of engagement with indigenous peoples, what is the extent of awareness of the UNDP staff from headquarters to the country level on this, and how is this used to guide the work of the staff? Question number three, on region and country specific initiatives. A. While recognizing the importance of RIPP, is UNDP developing other regional or global programs focused on indigenous peoples? Letter B. In countries or regions, has the UNDP been most effective in its work on indigenous peoples' issues? What have been the major substantive areas of cooperation? C. What have been the main barriers to undertaking projects focused on indigenous peoples in other regions? D. How does the UNDP, in its partnership with governments and national programs, contribute to the inclusion of indigenous issues and peoples into national policy processes? E. What has been the impact of the interagency working groups and indigenous peoples' advisory committees in Bolivia and Kenya? Are these experiences likely to be replicated in other countries? F. In countries where there are government agencies that are supposed to address the situation of indigenous peoples, what is the degree of participation of these government agencies in your programs? G. What is the extent of your involvement in the programs that you fund? Is it limited to funding, or does it extend to the determination on who are the beneficiaries and the partners involved, such as the IPOs and the NGOs? Now we go to internal capacity. A. Is the UNDP well-equipped to work on indigenous peoples' issues? Is there sufficient expertise and are UNDP staff members with the necessary understanding, knowledge, and first-hand experience with indigenous communities? B. What actions, initiatives can be taken to strengthen the capacity of UNDP to work in the area of indigenous peoples' issues more effectively and increase the number of specialists on indigenous peoples' issues among UNDP staff? D. What has been the impact so far of the Indigenous Peoples UNDP Liaison Committee in terms of strengthening internal capacity to better address indigenous peoples' issues at the corporate level and to ensure greater synergies? Question number five, MDG and HDR reports. What actions can be pursued to ensure that indigenous peoples' issues are better addressed in human development reports and national MDG reports, and that they are consulted in the production of these reports? Question on RED. What is the UNDP's role in RED, and how does UNDP intend to apply the principles laid out in the declaration and the recommendations of the Permanent Forum in this area? B. What actions are being taken by UNDP to ensure that indigenous peoples are not alienated or negatively affected by the RED program? C. Will the UN RED Program Policy Board consider the strategies to address the underlying causes of deforestation? We go to question number seven, global environmental facility. A. What is the small grants program doing to enhance access to SGP UNDP funding for indigenous peoples? How successful was the effort to get video proposals from the indigenous peoples? How many such proposals have been approved? And what is the assessment in terms of how such projects are being implemented? Which projects are directly financing indigenous peoples without NGO intervention? How does the implementation methodology strengthen the economic, social, cultural, political, or organizational capacities of indigenous peoples? Please cite specific instances. Letter B, other potential intellectual property issues around the development of appropriate mapping techniques, such as cyber tracker tools, participatory geographic information system, participatory video for the documentation of indigenous peoples' conservation areas. 8, community-based adaptation. A, how can the UNDP support indigenous peoples' efforts in community-based adaptation to climate change? B, what have been the impact and the main lessons learned, good practices from UNDP's community-based adaptation projects with indigenous peoples? C, paragraph 16 of the report of UNDP mentions 3 projects on CBA, namely Guatemala, Vietnam, and Bolivia. How are indigenous peoples participating in these projects? Are they being involved in the design and implementation of the processes, and are the community organization systems being taken into account? Are there specialists on indigenous people's issues and or indigenous professionals on the staff of these projects? Question number 9, second to the last question. Number interagency cooperation. Letter A, how can UNDP and the UNIFIL best collaborate to develop capacities in UN country teams and offices and ensuring the implementation of the declaration and in particular articles 41 and 42? B, how is the UNDP contributing to interagency efforts to promote the rights of indigenous peoples and their mainstreaming within the UN system? C, as the UNDP acts as a country team coordinator for the various UN agencies and bodies at the country level, how useful are the UNDG guidelines on indigenous people's issues in terms of uniting and collaborative work among the members? 10, and the last question. Questions received from the IPOs and NGOs. A, what is the UNDP doing about housing and poor social development in recognition of the huge impact this have on tuberculosis? B, what is UNDP doing to address the situation of urban indigenous peoples? So as I have previously said, we leave it to the UNDP to determine which questions will be answered by them first and to answer them later if the time is not sufficient.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eugenio Insigne. These questions have been provided to the UNDP earlier, so I'm sure you have discussed amongst yourself how you will respond to some of these questions. So I would like to give the floor back to you and tell us what the process is in terms of the responses, Mr. Admiral Kirk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you also to Mr. Insigne for raising these questions. I admire your political skills because you say you have 10 questions, but in fact you asked 50. And at the same time, I really welcome also those questions. Obviously, not everything can be answered in every detail today. We are standing ready to provide more written questions, but I must honestly say that also some questions should lead us to more internal consideration and dialogue also in the interagency discussion in order really to see whether we are well equipped, whether we have the requisite expertise in-house, and what, probably also on the basis of the conclusions of your work this week, we should additionally consider in order to be really a good partner in your endeavor, not only here in the headquarters dialogue, but particularly at the level where the real work of UNDP is happening at the country level. And clearly, I mean, you no doubt will have examples of that. There are different situations. Some country teams are more sensitive, more informed, more creative than others. And of course, we feel a responsibility to encourage everyone to be as responsive as they should be. But if there are issues, you should also not hesitate to bring them to our attention. So what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is just briefly make a few more general remarks from my position, then ask Rebecca and the colleagues on the bench to take up a few of the specific issues that could be easily answered now, speaking not more than two minutes per person, and then we can wrap up in the way that you would deem fit. I would just like to make two remarks in particular. It's about the niche for UNDP, and it's about our role in supporting processes, promoting the position and interests of indigenous peoples at local and national level, including dealing with the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. Concerning our niche, I think it is important to share with you how we see the role of UNDP. UNDP is by definition working with the member states, with the governments. They are also our key stakeholders in terms of their participation and decision making in our executive board. And obviously we also get our resources from member states of the UN. Now, in that dialogue through our executive board, we of course try to define as good as we can the development agenda as we see it and to organize a consensus on that. And that is what you have been able to see in our strategic plan that is available to all of you, that we see as a living document, but that really plots the course of UNDP in working with and for the poorest in the world, and certainly including the indigenous communities, both because in many instances they are belonging to the poorest, but also because their voice, their participation, is essential to make ownership a real proposition, not only something of governments, because we on a permanent basis share with governments that the government cannot be effective without involving society at large in many ways. Then of course it is certainly a matter of governments and parliaments to decide what are the best possible ways, but then it is up to UNDP, and you can count on UNDP for that, to support your organizations, to support your work in terms of bringing it to the forefront of attention, using publications, dialogues, platforms, interactive work to make sure that the views of indigenous peoples are part and parcel of an overall decision-making process. And I was happy also that you mentioned the human development reports that are an exceedingly important communication channel by and through UNDP in order to make the voices of the poor heard in many places, in many ways. Now, when you talked about free prior informed consent and you asked how does UNDP, quote unquote, secure the application of that principle, I put a note to the word secure. What we cannot do is secure. This is something that is really up to you and your representatives and, of course, to parliaments and other representatives in national and local settings to do. we as an international organization on behalf of the UN cannot take over responsibility that is essentially rooted in local and national communities. But what we can do is support, advise, advocate, share best practices, and make sure that there is a connection between all those throughout the world that work for the same cause. And that is why I'm here. That is why my colleagues are at your disposal, really, to guide you, to support you, to advise you here and at the country level. And this is why it makes it so important to seek in our dialogue what the best instruments and ways are to deal with those responsibilities. But it's very important to distinguish in the level of responsibilities that we have and that we can assume. So with your permission, I would like Rebecca now to take the floor. Thank you.
Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much. And before I give the floor to my colleagues here on the right, I would like to refer to some of the specific issues raised. The first one is about the participation mechanism in Bolivia. Please allow me to share with you that the UNDP representative in Bolivia headed the organization of the last enlarged or extended meeting of the council. She was the only agency head that participated in all the council's deliberations. At that meeting, the UNDP representative took on two significant commitments. The first one was to promote permanent political dialogue with indigenous organizations on the political, social, and economic situation in Bolivia. And within that framework, the Bolivian representative met several times with the leaders of indigenous organizations in Bolivia to exchange information and deal with issues relating to constitutional reform, peaceful conflict resolutions, and promoting the fiscal policy so that the world financial crisis would not have a deeper impact on Bolivia and on indigenous people there. The second commitment was to support initiatives to contribute to capacity building that would have an impact on public policies affecting indigenous peoples. Not much progress has been made on that one, but given political circumstances, but this is something that is being taken in earnest, and there have been a lot of headlines about this in Bolivia. Within this framework, it is worthwhile mentioning that the trade union organization for indigenous people in Bolivia has also reached an agreement on certain initiatives in line with the new constitution. So I hope I've answered at least one of your questions. The second thing I'd like to mention on the list is about our capacity building. And here I would like to say that the challenge we have and which we are taking ownership of with the regional program is that these capacities exist, but only in those people working on indigenous issues. Now it is important to train people involved in other areas in those skills, because what is important is that these principles be incorporated into everything we do, in democratic governance, in poverty, in the Millennium Development Goals, in the environment. So they have to be cross-cutting, not just in those people who deal with indigenous issues, but also those people who work on general subjects within the organization. I think that is the major challenge that we have, and that is why I referred to the need that I think is covered by the workshops to train people in the Declaration and the rights of indigenous people. That's for our country teams and in our offices. And the last subject I'd like to refer to is the Human Development Reports and the Millennium Development Goal Reports. As far as Human Development Reports are concerned, Latin America is one of the most active regions in the National Human Development Reports, and also with regards to indigenous peoples, I think we have some best practices in our region, and what we've done in Mexico, I think, could be used for indigenous peoples in other countries and regions. I'd like to stress how important it is to use Millennium Development Goal reports to deal with this subject. Here I have a report on the Millennium Development Goals that we compiled. It's called Ethnicity and the Millennium Development Goals in Latin America. In that report, we show that many countries are achieving the goals, but when we break down the information and we see that for indigenous populations or for Afro descendants, we see that the results are not that good. We also have interagency reporting on the Millennium Development Goals for the whole of Latin America, and there we provide a detailed breakdown of the data. I think that it is important to take into account the comments that you've made about these reports so that we can include these subjects. In Latin America, we do have best interagency practices. Thank you, and I'll give the floor to my colleagues on the panel to answer the other questions. Thank you.
Beatriz, you have the floor.
First of all, my name is Beatriz Hernandez. I'm the focal point for indigenous peoples in the UNDP. I would like to refer to the importance of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It has, I think, provided great impetus to the work and the commitment of the UN Development Programme in this whole area. Madam Chair, in the UNDP, we are fully aware of the fact that for indigenous issues, the international framework has been strengthened. The UNDP's commitment has become a specific programmed plan, including different themes. We've already mentioned a new program with the IUP, which seeks to promote the representation and better understanding of indigenous people in our parliaments. There is also a new regional initiative for Latin America, and the UNDP is exploring a new global framework cooperation with the ILO and with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So, members of the Permanent Forum in the UNDP, we do hope that this forum will play an essential role in supporting us throughout the process and in successfully completing the projects we are working on currently and the new initiatives we'll be launching in the future. Now, I would like to give the floor to my colleagues here on the panel. Thank you.
Chandra Roy, yes.
Good morning. I'm Chandra Roy, and I'm working with UNDP on the Regional Initiative on Indigenous Peoples' Rights and Development in Asia. So I'll speak from the Asian perspective. One of the challenges we face, and you know that better than we do at UNDP, is how to better integrate Indigenous people's issues into the government policies and programs. What we're doing through our program is to provide a little bit of a space. It's a very small contribution. We just started about 4 years ago. And we do this through having these dialogues that Mr. Melkert had mentioned, where you have policy dialogues, which are on critical issues, and try to provide a space for Indigenous peoples and governments to dialogue together and identify one of the main challenges and obstacles and how they can work together in trying to bridge that gap. One of the key elements that we have found very useful in our work in implementing this is having the inclusion of Indigenous peoples throughout every level. For instance, we have Indigenous peoples on our advisory board, and they are the ones that decide and tell us what kind of work we should be working on for the future. I'm very happy to say that Ms. Thauli Corpus is a member of our advisory committee. We also have Indigenous peoples involved in the policy, in the projects that we implement, and this is with specific reference to the declaration. We are undertaking a training, a capacity building project, which tries to provide training and skills for negotiation, for dialogue, using the UN declaration and incorporating that into the human rights-based approach to development from the perspective of Indigenous peoples. We do this through an Indigenous Peoples Task Force. We have AIPP, which is the Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact, as one of our main partners in this. And this is ongoing, where we bring Indigenous peoples. We're also going to be providing the support to government agencies. In countries where there are government agencies that work on Indigenous peoples, we, of course, involve them very directly. For instance, in one specific example is actually from Mr. Insigne himself, because he's the chairperson of the National Commission on Indigenous Peoples. Philippines UNDP is putting together a comprehensive program on Indigenous peoples, and one of the main partners is going to be NCIP together with Indigenous peoples. And we're now in the process of putting this program together, and we are including Indigenous peoples as the implementers of the program, but also on the advisory committee, so that they're involved not just in implementing, but also in guiding and evaluating and monitoring how the work is being undertaken. I will stop there and leave it to my other colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chandra Roy. Who's the next person?
And I'm the my name is Gary Keneal, and I'm the team leader with the MDGs at BDP. I think Rebecca captured quite well the issue of the MDG reports and including Indigenous peoples' issues. I think I would only add three short points. The first issue is for us to always try to make sure that the data is actually available. In Latin America, for example, we get access to about 85% of MDG-related data. 10% of the data is usually projections by agencies, and the rest is often non-existent. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's closer to 60. So the first important task is for us to make sure that the data is existent and that it's of quality and that it's disaggregated. So in practical terms, that means partnering with our country offices to know when these surveys will be held, be part of the process of developing the tools, making sure that the tools integrate the elements and the information that are required. The second element is, of course, making sure that the guidelines for these reports include the elements of indigenous peoples. And there, we are currently working with our partners to propose a revision of the guidelines for the national MDG reports so that they systematically include human rights issues and indigenous people issues. The third element, which I think is also crucial, is to make sure that the national strategies and the national plans build on this disaggregated data. Often now in several of our countries, what happens is these national plans, as you well know, build on aggregate data. And what we have done so far is to revise some of the tools that we use to help governments develop these national strategies to make sure that the plans build on and plan according to this disaggregated information. These are the three points I would add. Thank you.
Okay, I think we need to have give you just 5 minutes for so that we can open it now to the floor. Who's the next one? Yes, Dr. Charles McNeil, you have the floor.
Good morning. I'm Charles McNeil with UNDP's Environment and Energy Group, and I'm going to respond to the questions. What is UNDP's role in RED? And RED stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation in Developing Countries. And how does UNDP intend to apply the principles laid out in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the recommendations of the Permanent Forum, your own recommendations from last year? And the second question is, what actions are being taken by UNDP to ensure that Indigenous peoples are not alienated or negatively affected by the RED program? And there's no more important group for us to talk to in the world than this group here, and I'm really delighted to be able to engage with you. As you know, RED, or as you may know, RED is about providing incentives to countries to slow down or stop deforestation, and the idea is for industrialized countries to make financial transfers to developing countries to lead to low-carbon, sustainable development paths to development. And we know that RED is important because 20% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions come from deforestation, and there's no way to stop the worst aspects of climate change without doing something about the forest issue. And Indigenous peoples are already suffering from climate change impacts. They're already suffering from the loss of forests, so we need to do everything we can to stop that. And we also want you to know that we've listened carefully to the concerns of Indigenous peoples since the Bali Climate Change Meeting and the UN Permanent Forum last year and the Alaska Global Indigenous Peoples Summit and the events this week. We know there are strong, strong concerns, and we are interested and we're committed to avoiding the worst aspects and to ensure that RED is actually useful. UNDP is working with FAO and UNEP in something called the UN RED Program. And that's designed to help developing countries build capacity to implement RED, including the engagement of Indigenous peoples. UNDP's role in particular responds to national programs that are being developed in the countries. We have 9 pilot countries. And secondly, UNDP's job is to help ensure that stakeholders and Indigenous peoples are informed, are engaged in the process. We also are responsible for ensuring that the RED framework is pro-poor and addresses governance issues, and that lessons are distributed widely and that we learn from the experience. The question, how do we plan to respond to the UN Permanent Forum recommendations from last year? Those recommendations are several. We've been paying close attention to them. The issue of using the climate change situation to secure the rights of Indigenous peoples and reward their historic stewardship. We agree this is the direction that RED needs to go, and we're working to have this happen. The principle of free, prior, and informed consent is built into our guidelines, and this is a way to ensure that Indigenous people are not excluded. There also is the call, you're saying the current framework is not supported by most Indigenous peoples and that you want to new proposals that build on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and we agree with that. We have embedded the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People in our guidelines, and you're also asking that the RED address the global and national policy reforms. It's clear that policy reforms are needed for RED to work. In terms of what actions are we taking, we have developed Indigenous Peoples guidelines, and we have copies of these guidelines for you in Spanish, French, and English in the back of the room there. Secondly, we're having a consultation next Wednesday in this room at lunchtime, as Mr. Ad Melkert mentioned, to get your engagement and advice on this. So we want your advice, but we already have these guidelines developed and in motion. We are calling for the adherence to the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. We also are involving Indigenous peoples in project formulation and national steering committees. There are activities and resources being allocated to this. This is our commitment. If there are any issues with this that you're aware of, please let us know. We also, a very important development happened. The first board meeting of the UN RED agreed that Indigenous peoples will be represented on the board. This is the first time in any instrument like this that I'm aware of where Indigenous membership and 3 observers of Indigenous people will be participating in all the decision-making on how the UN RED program develops. Similarly, there'll be a CSO representative and 3 CSO observers. So Indigenous peoples and CSOs are involved in the governance of the UN RED program. We're also establishing a recourse mechanism. If there's a problem in a country, there are means to make these problems known. And we are participating in fora like this so that we can hear your concerns and learn and develop the program. We're also collaborating closely with the World Bank to make sure that we learn from each other. We've agreed to bring together our indigenous people's guidelines so that the agency with the highest standard is the mechanism that applies to both agencies. So we're clear that we have to learn from each other and help each other respond to your concerns. And finally, I would just want to reiterate that the guidelines are available for your review in three languages, a side event next Wednesday, but also today at lunchtime at the UNDP office on 45th Street, we will be having a consultation on UNDP's strategy for local capacity and local action in the environment group. We invite you to that meeting as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charles. At this point, I don't like to call. I'd like you to please hold on first because we'll just need to hear the points that some of the speakers have raised, that they would like to raise, and we just have a few speakers. So please, I beg your indulgence, we'll move on to the list first and then we'll come back again to your responses. You can bring it up again afterwards. I'd like to call on Saudata Abubakrin from the Africa Women's Caucus. And again, I reiterate that please focus on your questions or recommendations if you have. Okay, thank you very much, Saudata. You have the floor, Saudata.
Merci, madam.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. In most African states, indigenous peoples are marginalized and do not have the capacity to lobby to get our rights respected. Although we do hope to see that this will change with the declaration and ILO Convention 169 and the CBD. There are different UN organizations, the European Commission, the World Bank, and others that have made commitments. The effectiveness of actions, though, requires a way to get indigenous people more involved. We have seen that we've had minimum opportunities in the last decade. There are some very dynamic networks such as IPAC or WAFA for the Indigenous Women of Africa, then grassroots organizations that have set up these organizations, and we should not overlook the diaspora in the West. This can be a link between grassroots organizations and development protagonists within the United Nations system. This is an essential element for us. I've said all of this before I ask my question. What does the UN system expect from countries vis-a-vis a procedure to get indigenous peoples involved? What about cooperation with these organizations and with indigenous peoples, because nothing is being done so far except some token efforts in some countries? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Saudata. I'd like to call on Gotom Kumar Chakma, who will speak on behalf of the Indigenous People's Caucus of Asia. Gotom, are you in the room? Yes, you have the floor.
Good morning to all, and thanks to the chair for giving us this floor. In the meantime, some questions have already been raised. That is why I am raising very few questions just to supplement and to emphasize on them. One, how can UNDP help initiate the establishment of independent monitoring mechanisms on the implementation of free, prior, and informed consent? Two, do country offices raise their concerns on violations of the rights of indigenous peoples in the implementation of the development projects? 3. Do UNDP have planning to increase funds for Asia, particularly for RIPP, to sustain, strengthen, and expand its program? 4. How UNDP can provide financial support to indigenous peoples, institutions, and organizations? And last question is number 5. Would UNDP arrange a study on the programs undertaken in Bolivia, Chitanhilda, etc., to find out the best practices and to have their replications? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gautam Chakma from the Asian Indigenous Peoples Caucus. I'd like to call now on the government, the representative of the observer government of Denmark, Mr. Andreas Balzer Jorgensen. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Denmark congratulates UNDP with the emphasis given to indigenous peoples in the present program in Asia and the Pacific and the upcoming program in Latin America and the Caribbean. As far as we can see, these are, however, the only major programs focusing on indigenous peoples. The main remainder of UNDP's activities involving indigenous peoples seem to be quite small projects that only occupy a small part of all UNDP's activities. Moreover, when reading the report, we noticed a lack of reference to ways of mainstreaming indigenous peoples into all relevant UNDP programs and projects. This makes me forward 4 questions which the Danish government places great emphasis on. There will be some repetitions from the earlier ones, but I think it should be mentioned. Is UNDP having any plans to mainstream indigenous issues in all programming, planning systems, and planning cycles? UNDP has no agency strategy for the incorporation of indigenous peoples. Is there any plans to develop such an agency strategy? UNDP country offices need staff which are familiar with indigenous issues. How does UNDP plan to capacity build all its country offices in countries with indigenous peoples? Because that will be a great task. And then I finally also mention the importance of the free, prior, informed consent and how UNDP will enter into that process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Andreas Jorgensen, who is from the government of Denmark. The next government is from Nicaragua, Mr. Stedman Fagoth. You have the floor, sir.
Madam Chairman, 2 things basically, 2 specific points. One is the way in which, or how can, we coordinate our efforts to ensure that regional authorities and UNDP representatives within the context of the Declaration of the United Nations, especially paragraph 34, can pool their efforts, the efforts enshrined in this declaration and the regional organizations. And I have a recommendation more than a question for UNDP's efforts to be geared more to the territories affected by Hurricane Felix. So a little more focused effort might be required vis-à-vis the indigenous peoples that suffered from that hurricane. So those were the 2 main points I wanted to make. Anything else can be put in writing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stedman Fagoth. I see the cards of my colleagues up. Are you going to ask questions also, Elisa and Bartolome? Okay, I'll give the floor to Elisa Kanki and then later on to Bartolome Clavero.
Thank you. Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, madam. I'd like to ask a question or two of the panelists. First of all, I'd like to thank them for being with us so that we can have a direct dialogue with the indigenous peoples and you. And I wanted to ask a question, however. Is the UNDP going to change its working methodology? Many of the actions which you're carrying out in countries are focused on the major towns and cities, or support for national policies and in developing your strategic documents. And we as indigenous people see that a lot of the resources seem to go into paper and not to specific projects which are genuinely useful to the indigenous peoples and communities. Thank you.
And Bartolome Clavero, you have the floor.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, madam. And good morning to everybody. Thank you, too, for this opportunity to exchange views with UNDP here in this forum. I'd like to make a suggestion and also ask a question. As far as the suggestion is concerned, it's something which I think UNDP already has in mind. That is the need for a regional program in Latin America. And I say this for a very straightforward reason, because of the extreme inequality in the offices of UNDP in the various countries of Latin America as far as regards their approach to indigenous issues. Some offices are completely unreceptive, insensitive to indigenous issues. There are others, on the other hand, which are doing a good job and are very much conscious of the demands, especially of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And a regional program would make it possible to have the best possible sort of harmonization and lead to a better focus of UNDP's work vis-à-vis the indigenous peoples. My question is very specific. Again, it's on Latin America's experience, and it's with respect to Bolivia. The case of Bolivia was used as an exemplar to be used by other offices, but please don't. I don't know what internal mechanisms you have for validating the reports of the offices, but the Bolivian Council is not working. Where there have been the most serious events in a certain number of months in Bolivia, the Council didn't even meet. So I'd like to ask, what internal mechanisms does UNDP have to check the reports coming from the country offices and to verify that things are actually working as these reports claim or purport that they're doing? Because I repeat, the Bolivian office is just not working. I'm sorry to have to bring you such sorry tidings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Margaret.
Thank you very much. May I thank the UNDP for having given a comprehensive report. I'm going to ask a very simple question regarding the working of UNDP at the grassroots level. I'm aware UNDP in most countries deals directly with the governments. I'm talking for the case of African countries, for instance, Uganda. You find that UNDP is linked directly with big organizations and local governments, but does not directly deal with indigenous peoples, much as it may be having good programs. My question is, how do you ensure that UNDP engages directly with indigenous peoples now that the declaration is in place? Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like now to move to the UNDP colleagues, to Karsten. Karsten, yes, you have the floor.
Yes, I have some questions I would like to put. Like I say, there have been such so many questions around here that for some time, as an old judge, I felt almost to be back in the courts of law. But I'd like to to underline to our guests that you are among friends here in the permanent forum. But I think a fundamental question is the priority that the office is allocating to the indigenous people's problem in the total working program. For, of course, the indigenous people's problems are only one sector of your very large working field, and it must necessarily occupy only a part of your resources and of your working capacity. And how is the decision-making process on this point? It's of vital importance for the indigenous peoples, and then also for the permanent forum. And what are the criteria for these decisions within the office and its system? I would also like to put a question on the declaration. The declaration is now the superior law for the forum on all indigenous issues. And what is the position of the declaration in the overall strategy of the office? And does the office have some views on the binding effect of the declaration? I would also like to put questions on the forum as a partner in the UPR. Will the office accept the forum as a more active participant in this review? And if so, how shall this become organized in a positive way? And to what extent have the rights of indigenous peoples been addressed in the UPR process, and has the office...
Carsten,
yes?
Can I just remind you that question that you are raising now is actually for the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, the UPR process. So can we get that under the... when we talk with the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights? You were talking about the universal periodic review.
Yes, but my question, it ended in whether it could be a kind of combination here. But then, as a last question, that is the appropriate way of handling human rights complaints that may arise of sessions at the forum. And it is mentioned by the office itself as one of the areas for exchanges today. The forum is well organized as a body for input of complaints, but not as a body for management and finalizing of these problems. Shall now the forum transfer them by way of recommendation to the office, or maybe to the special rapporteur, or are there better methods, in the opinion of the office, to handle these questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carsten. I'd like now to turn to to the colleagues from the UNDP. So, Mr. Milker, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you also for these quite pertinent questions. And again, I'd like to emphasize that trying to answer to those questions right now is not just for this morning. It's really giving us also some homework, and I can really assure you that we will internally also look for a proper assessment of the issues that came forward from this forum to the extent that they could or should have implications for the work of UNDP, both at headquarters and at national level. So let me pick up a few points and from the outset say that issues related to, say, the legal nature of the permanent forum and its role, I better leave to the High Commissioner, not because we don't have a view, but because I think in the Division of Labour within the UN system it's really better to also make a division of the way that we respond to your points. So I think overall, from the UNDP perspective, the most important thing is really to look at mainstreaming, and that is really a mainstreaming point, also in response to the Danish questions, of the participation of representatives of indigenous groups and peoples at relevant stages of decision-making in any development process. That is, I think, where overall UNDP is best located, and in terms of its mandate, also authorized to advise governments at the national and the municipal level to make sure that there are inclusive processes of decision-making. So the question from Africa should be responded in this way. We, as UNDP, are in many developing countries a close partner of governments in organizing development strategy processes, supporting those processes. And there we can advocate, and we should, that you and your representatives are really involved and engaged from an early start of decision-making processes until the end, but of course respecting constitutions of countries and the way that countries have organized themselves. We can support that process also, and this is my response to the questions from Asia, by ensuring that best practices are generally accessible, that we produce reports that build on those best practices and that we make them available to a wide array of partners at a government level, but also at the level of civil society and the representatives of your group, so that you can benefit from good practices in other countries. We stand by to make sure that institutions can function. We don't have a direct role in financing such institutions, but we certainly can help find ways to make sure that you get the support for institutions that are representatives of your views. And I think also the idea of independent monitoring mechanisms is interesting. It should be looked at a country-by-country basis, because I think every country situation is different and would require different ways of dealing with monitoring, but it's absolutely adequate to look at monitoring mechanisms in order to make sure that promises are being kept, follow-up is being given to commitments, and that also multilateral partners such as ours could be held accountable for the things that we say, but of course that we also have to do. And here is where I'd like to assure the government representative of Denmark that we are, on the basis of our strategic plan, committed to support UN country teams and our own UNDP country offices to make sure that in our strategy, in our programs, and also in the knowledge available through our staff at country level, there is adequate awareness and knowledge represented on indigenous peoples' issues, but as he will no doubt be aware of, we are dealing with many demands and many policies that need to be addressed, and yet have to work with scarce resources, because we are a network of organizations in more than of representation in more than 150 countries. And obviously, with our scarce resources, we cannot do everything at the same time. But it's a serious matter to make sure that all country officers are equipped, well equipped, and are responsive to the issues. And here I think it would be good to ask Rebecca to say a few things on the particular questions that came forward on the situation in the Latin American regions and some country offices, and maybe then we still would have some minutes to turn back to our panel. Thank you very much.
Yes, Rebecca, please.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you for the questions. To the colleague for Nicaragua, I'd like to express deep thanks for that statement. There are indeed two important projects which might be bolstered in response to the recommendation which you've provided us with, especially on the question of joining efforts between the declaration and the programs and statutes of the communal territories of the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, this autonomous question. There's a job which hasn't been properly done then, which has to be done, so thank you for that question. Also on the question of Hurricane Felix, which did so much damage to your territories, I will certainly focus on what's being done there as well in due course. So thank you for that question. As regards to working methodology, that I think is a very important point that Elisa raised. In my first statement, I said quite frankly and openly that I can't say that everything we've done has necessarily taken into account the various fora for dialogue, for implementation of all the programs. We've had to change what needed changing, and I can assure you that we have already had to change programs already adopted in order to incorporate these fora for dialogue, consultation, and participation. Sometimes we need to have a clear awareness of what's required for us to proceed. Not everything that needs to be done has been done, I must concede. As Mr. Clavelo said, there are some offices which have been more receptive than others, others who are less keen. We're working on workshops to raise awareness of all the region's offices. So the question of training our own officers, not just governments and civil society, and not just national programs, this has become a very important element in our regional cooperation program. So I agree with you. This is important for us to have a regional program in order to tackle the cultural issues facing many of the offices of the group. This can't be brought about just by a degree from on high. It has to be, it involves work, it involves persuasion, it involves awareness work. As far as support for national policies is concerned, and exclusive emphasis on the towns and cities, I have to disagree. Because if you look at the evolution of the program in Latin America, our program is increasingly being geared to decentralization and support precisely for municipal governments or indeed specific territories. Increasingly, that's the case. Now, we can't abandon the question of national policies because of something which could prove to be very dangerous, and that is for national policy to just ignore what's going on in the territories. There's a whole question of transfer of resources and responsibility, which will be lost in national policy if we don't have a proper combination between the two. Being able to give more capacity, more resources and attention to the territories, while also ensuring that national policy feels that it bears a responsibility for everything happening on the country's territory, not just in the cities. But increasingly, we've been moving in this direction. And then there's another very important issue I'd like to raise. In Latin America, only 10% of UNDP resources are from donations from outside. The rest is resources from the governments in the region itself. So the question of resources is one of trying to win over governments to earmark resources for this purpose. But the truth is that Latin America is not a region which has a great deal of cooperation. You know that it's declined an enormous amount over recent years. So there's a real job here of convincing people so that national policies give priority to providing resources for these issues. And then as far as Bartolomé is concerned about Bolivia is concerned, I'll check this out. But I'd like us to thrash this out together. You're right on one point. For more than a year, we didn't have a representative in Bolivia, so the council was completely inactive. It was reactivated last year when there were a number of consultations held. So I'd like us to check out this information and see whether or not this is a mechanism which is going to work in future. What I do think is important is for there to be a proper consultations mechanism, a standing one and not an ad hoc one, and I'm sure we'll find a way of doing that. And I think I've answered all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go back to the panel. I think it was Terence raising his flag. Yes, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to respond to the question from the representative of Uganda regarding direct access to funding for indigenous peoples. I will speak on behalf of the GEF Small Grants Program and the questions that were raised on community-based adaptation to climate change. In terms of direct access, one of the main ways that the GEF Small Grants Program is enabling indigenous peoples to submit proposals has been through geographic focus in the countries where we work. In previous years of the Permanent Forum, we have invited grantees from Mexico and Guatemala, where we have a geographic focus in Mayan territories. In the last 3 years, we have started programs in Argentina, in the northwest of the country, also in indigenous areas. In Panama, we have a geographic focus in the Darién. In Africa, in the last year, our program will be starting in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the province of Equateur, and also in the Central African Republic, focusing in indigenous areas. In regard to proposal formats, 2 years ago we launched the participatory video handbook. It has now been translated into 5 languages, and we've been receiving participatory video proposals in at least 7 countries. If you go to the UNDP newsroom website, you will see a participatory video made in March by Baka hunter-gatherers in Cameroon, which was submitted as a proposal for funding to the Small Grants Program in Cameroon. In addition, we have many other ways of supporting capacity building, but I will limit my comments to the new area of work on community-based adaptation. Currently, we are piloting in 10 countries community-based adaptation methodologies. We recognize that traditional knowledge systems have provided long-term resilience to environmental change, and we would like to strengthen and support all forms of documentation and support to traditional knowledge systems for the future. In addition, some questions were raised about the work that we are doing in Guatemala, Vietnam, and Bolivia. We will address those separately in a written statement. Lastly, I would just say that in relation to our governance system, we have indigenous representatives in our national steering committees in the countries where we work. And therefore, indigenous representatives are involved in the approval of projects. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Terence. Hey, AD, is there anybody else on that panel who is going to take the floor? Yes, please, you have the floor. We have a few minutes left.
I'd like to add briefly to something that was clearly explained by the Regional Director for Latin America, Rebecca Greenspan. And I think these may be illustrative examples which can be of general application. There was this question about personnel, staff working in the UNDP office. In the case of Guatemala, it's an indigenous person who has entire responsibility for pursuing a very extensive program which has 6 major projects. I'd like to refer to two of the six, because there's also a question of general questions. One is the PASOK program for alliances or partnerships with civil society, the aim of which is to strengthen civil society organizations, especially indigenous organizations and rural ones, of which the bulk of which are indigenous people. And then I'd also like to refer to participation with a voice and a vote in the development councils at the community levels, municipal and departmental levels as well. That's a genuine way of ensuring that there is real participation in terms of political participation and political power. Then there's the everything that's been said about implementation of the agreement for indigenous rights in the context of the peace agreement. There are some documents which are seeking to change the culture in countries along the lines of a multi-ethnic, pluralistic approach. In Guatemala, the Human Development Report of 2005 was very specific about ethnic and cultural diversity and the citizenry in a pluralistic state to see how one can overcome the existing asymmetries with respect to the indigenous populations. And more recently, in 2007, there was a document produced on the Mayan vision in the sense of the fullness of life. But this was essentially geared to people of a Western outlook, so they have better awareness both in governments and in non-governmental, non-Mayan organizations to understand how one needs to incorporate this other world vision. And then there's the manual for participation of indigenous peoples in policies and cooperation for human development, so that the indigenous peoples of Guatemala can take more active part in public policy making. Two additional points with respect to Bolivia. I'd refer to a precedent when the Consultative Council sought to promote human rights and indigenous rights in 2004. Then, of course, there have been more recent developments, but I'd especially like to highlight the role of the office in supporting, negotiating, and peaceful settlement of disputes mechanisms, especially with respect to the last constitution and the problem of the autonomous communities and support for the Ministry for the Autonomous Communities, which has to provide a normative framework for institutional capacity building programs for implementation by the indigenous autonomous government. So there's another thing which goes beyond the Consultative Council, and that is these other entities which are very important with respect to the political authority and the new constitution. The last thing is the suggestion, very important suggestion made by Mr. Clavero about the existence of a regional program. I'd like to say that at present there is already a regional initiative which was launched in March to make systematic best practices in Bolivia, Guatemala, Colombia, Ecuador, Suriname. And one of the upshots of this may be the emergence of this regional program on the basis of an evaluation of best practice. This involves four national workshops with the participation of the indigenous peoples in Honduras, Peru, Panama, and Nicaragua to see how we can better disseminate and make use of the Declaration on Indigenous Rights, strengthen analysis thereof, and have a human rights approach integrated into these operations. I think these are elements which will buttress the things that have been requested here. And I think it will be taken into account by the Regional Directorate when it comes to producing a new program which may cover the whole gamut of the continent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would just like, we are running out of time and we have to go to the FAO now, and after that we go to the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. But first, let me just say a few things in terms of what I have heard. I think that the contributions that have been presented to us really gives us a more realistic view of what UNDP is doing. I think they did try to adjust some of their programs to the changing situations, like, of course, climate change, as well as the UN adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and, of course, the existence of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We can see there are steps being taken to really put more indigenous issues into the different programs as well as in the different regions. I cannot give a full a conclusion on this, but I really think that there is a good indication of UNDP moving towards becoming more sensitive and responsive to indigenous peoples in various regions. Of course, there is a very unequal development because there are regions which are not still that well established in terms of addressing these issues. But I think one of the calls that have been put forward is really to increase resources allotted for these kinds of work. Like, I come from Asia. I know about the Regional Initiative for Indigenous Peoples' Rights and Development, and I also know that they don't have very much budget. No, in fact, sometimes we do pitch in to help implement some of the programs. And I think the practice of just having budget for personnel, you know, is not enough, because we really need to have more budgets for programs and projects. And I know that we are in a global financial crisis and all of us are suffering from this, but maybe we can still look here and there and see how we can really put that. And of course, the member states who are here are the ones who are providing the resources for the UNDP to be able to carry out their mandate. So I would also appeal to the member states to increase whatever they can to really help implement these projects that are meant to address the dire situations of indigenous peoples all over the world. No, and so I would like to really profusely thank all of you. This is, you know, they have 15 people here with us now, which is quite remarkable. They have the number 2 man who is in command of the whole institution. So I think this is a very good example of how we can really improve that kind of dialogue and that kind of exchange. No doubt there are questions that remain unanswered. So for those who would like to ask questions but they didn't get the chance to do it, I will urge you to approach them directly, especially if you know under which program they are, and ask them the question. No, we will try our best to, again, manage this in a better way. But I think as a first experiment, I think this went very well, and I'm so happy that you showed a lot of cooperation and we really went back and forth to talk about this. And I think this is the way we should be doing the work of the forum, really encouraging exchanges and dialogues, because we can come up from that, we can come up with our own conclusions, which we will not do today, but we will send this to you and we can again exchange the information. So thank you very much, Mr. Admiral Kurt and Rebecca Greenspan. I'd like to give you also the floor.
Just very briefly, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think this is really a very interesting way of organizing and particularly intensifying a dialogue which needs to be of an ongoing nature. Of course, I liked very much also your appeal to member states to support us in our work, because there is a lot of issues on the development agenda. At the end of the day, they're all linked, but it's not always that easy to organize. But with our colleagues, who I also like to thank a lot, we are really very motivated to work with you, to support you where we can, and to advance the cause of development generally. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, let me thank you all and all the colleagues who are there and here. There are several of them, and I must tell you, these are people who are really the ones doing the work, so it's really a good opportunity for you to be able to touch base with them also. So thank you very much. Thanks to all the colleagues for contributing to all those questions, 50 questions. And we still have to distill all of those. And of course, the indigenous representatives as well as the governments who have also raised their questions. We really would like to engage the governments to also be actively involved with this, because after all, you are the governing council for these kinds of institutions. At the end of the day, you make the decisions. So we appeal to you to also be more engaged so that we will really have a full picture of what is a UN agency, which most indigenous peoples don't know about. I must tell you, I mean, in spite of the fact that we have been having these meetings, a lot of indigenous peoples are really not clear about what is a UN agency, a program, or a UN fund. No? So this is also an attempt to make it more graphic, more understandable, and indigenous peoples can see the opportunities as well as see the obstacles that you face. And we, as members of the forum, are definitely going to help also overcome some of these obstacles if these are within our own expertise and also mandate. Thank you very much, and we'll move on now to the Food and Agriculture Organization. Thank you. So can we ask the colleagues to come up here?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Can we ask our colleagues from FAO to also come up to the podium? I think there are three colleagues. Is that three? Yeah, I think so. Who are they? Okay. Let's move on. I call on the dear colleagues from FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, to please come up to the podium so we can start with this next review. Where are they?
Here they are.
Okay,
all here.
Oh, hi.
Here.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so you have...
Oh, thank you. I have a stiff competition.
Hi, Regina.
Hi, Vicky.
Yes. So will you take your seats? Okay. Can I ask for order in the room again, please? We have our colleagues from FAO who are going to make their presentations. And then afterwards, the colleagues from the forum will raise their questions. So, who is the first one who's going to make the presentation? Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay. They need a moment to set up the computer. So, yeah, it's okay. Yeah, a few minutes. Okay, they are going to use the PowerPoint presentation, the PowerPoint, and those who cannot see it from their side, the hard copy of the PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to you, no? So let's wait for the thing to come out there, and then we can proceed. This is the one, no? Who is the one who is there? While they are putting up the PowerPoint presentation, I would like to remind you again of the process that we're going to take. First, we'll give 15 to 20 minutes to the agency to introduce their presentation. So I hope the agencies will not go beyond that. And then we have questions from the permanent forum members, and then which will be a maximum of 15 minutes or shorter. And then we have responses by the agencies, which will go on for 25 minutes, questions from Indigenous Peoples Organizations and from the government delegations, and then we have responses from them and the concluding comments. So,
why won't we just also tell them when we're going to finish?
But we have them in the afternoon. We are going to finish at 1 o'clock.
After which?
Yeah. We will, and then we will continue from on 3 to 4. Because this is 2 hours for each of the agencies. So are we ready now?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll give you 15, maximum 20 minutes, okay. And then we'll move on to the questions. Okay, you have the floor, Eve Crawley.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here today.
First, can I ask for silence in the room, please? We have to respect our guests who are here with us. Please, those who want to carry conversations, you go outside the room.
Yeah.
Yes, Eve, you have
all right,
the floor.
It's an honor to be here today on behalf of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. I'm starting by showing a slide here, and I'm wondering if any of you in this room can tell me what you see.
Of course we can.
Does anyone know what that is?
It's an irrigation canal or a swamp.
It's more than an irrigation canal system. This is the Sucacoyos, which is a traditional irrigation system developed by indigenous peoples in Peru. And it's an example of the uniquely adapted technologies that indigenous peoples have developed over the millennia. In this particular case, there are trenches that are dug, and the water sits there, and during the day the sun soaks into the water and heats it. And then at night, when the temperatures drop, the heated water allows the crops to be protected from frost. It protects potatoes, indigenous potatoes, and quinoa varieties, among other things. And so it's a frost protection method, and the fact that the water is there also helps to guard against drought in periods of extended drought. So it's one of these systems, and it has symbolic values as well. And it's just one example of the many kinds of systems that indigenous peoples in different parts of the world have developed that show a unique relationship between people, land, spirituality, economics, and knowledge. And it basically shows that in order to preserve biological diversity, one also has to concentrate on cultural diversity. Indigenous knowledge, biodiversity, and cultural diversity are integrally connected and are critical for the survival of humanity. Now, my name is Eve Crowley. I have with me Regina Laub, and I also have with me Eliana Rioja de Casanova, who represents an indigenous organization. I'm going to be covering three areas. The first is an overview of FAO's work with indigenous peoples, and then some specifics of the engagement between FAO and indigenous peoples. And then finally, looking at some of the opportunities and limitations that our organization presents for future steps. Our mandate, the Food and Agriculture Organization focuses on improving agricultural productivity, raising levels of nutrition, and bettering the lives of rural populations in order to contribute to growth in the world economy. And when we talk about agriculture, we don't just mean crop production. We mean livestock, forestry, fisheries, natural resource management, and other dimensions of rural well-being. Rural areas are critically important for poverty reduction. Indigenous peoples are disproportionately represented among the poor, and depend greatly upon the environment and on agricultural activities for their survival. They also have immense knowledge to give to science and to the rest of the world for the conservation of these resources. There are three interlocking areas of work that FAO engages in with Indigenous peoples. One is the field program. Those are technical assistance programs in the field. The second is research and knowledge generation, including studies, statistics, and information. And the third has to do with policy level work, including international instruments. And I'm going to go into more detail on each of these now. With relation to the field program, we presented a report that focuses particularly on Latin America. And this is really the first time we've done a comprehensive report of our work. The example from Latin America is allowing us to zone in on one region and show some of the different thematic areas in which FAO engages. So it's representative in some ways of the work that we do in other regions as well. And I'm going to show you now what some of those themes are. In the future, we hope to focus on other regions. The first theme, food security, which is really the biggest theme. When we talk about food security, we mean food availability, access, utilization, and stability. It's not just about the quantity of food, it's about the quality of food and the cultural appropriateness of the food, about agricultural production, and about income generation. And part of the work is about supporting the capacity of both public and private institutions in order to strengthen food production and distribution. These include people's organizations, it includes extension agents, it includes trade policy. There's a whole range of different areas within the public and private spheres in which we engage. With regards to nutrition, some examples of, we all know that for Indigenous peoples, malnutrition, infant mortality, diabetes are disproportionately high within these communities. FAO is working on supporting a balanced, diverse, healthy, and culturally appropriate diets. One of the ways this is done in Latin America is through small enterprise development, such as vegetable production and chicken breeding. And to give one example, in Brazil, a telefood project worked with the Tapuya indigenous women, the Club de Madres from Piauí, and it was focused on the production of fresh vegetables aimed at reducing the daily expenses for self-sufficiency, improving family nutrition through the inclusion of vegetables within the diet, and increasing incomes by enabling these indigenous women's groups to sell their products in local markets. It's just one example. A third theme is natural resource management, which is, as we know, fundamental for Indigenous peoples and for their livelihoods. To give one example, sustainable forest management in Argentina, Chile, Nicaragua, Paraguay, Costa Rica, and Panama has really focused on policy support and building local capabilities and the rights of people living in forests, including Indigenous peoples, who are threatened by environmental degradation and instances of land dispossession. And we're working on building integrated development plans and strengthening the participation of forest communities in policy development. In Nicaragua, there was work done on developing forest legislation and improving the participation and capacity of local stakeholders to revise forestry legislation. In the Chorotega region, there was actually a draft law developed for Indigenous peoples' management of forests, and a great deal of work was done on raising awareness about the policies, laws, and regulations that affect Indigenous peoples and how they can benefit from them. In the area of enhancing traditional agricultural systems, which is a fourth theme, there's a focus on strengthening the long-standing expertise that in Indigenous communities already have that are uniquely adapted to their local environments. One example was the slide I showed at the beginning. That is an example of a pilot project this is an indigenous system, but FAO's working through the globally important agricultural heritage systems project to identify and support traditional systems that have been uniquely suited to their local environments, build on cultural knowledge, and deserve to be preserved. And there are multiple examples of this. In Peru, there's work, for example, with the Aymara and Quechua to preserve Inca land use practices in 4,000 meters and above. But that's one of many different pilot cases. We also have a thematic area connected to adaptation and mitigation of climate change. One example is the reducing emissions for deforestation and forest degradation program, which FAO engages in with UNDP and UNEP in a collaborative effort. And it focuses, among other things, on operational guidelines for engaging indigenous peoples and forest-dependent communities, indigenous representation on the UN Red Policy Board, and participation in the Independent Civil Society Advisory Group in Bolivia, Panama, and Paraguay. We also have work in supporting communication initiatives of indigenous peoples to put forward their own priorities and to strengthen their communications among themselves, including honoring their rights to free, prior, and informed consent in relation to carbon sequestration and community-based adaptation. There's also a series of work connected to emergency and disaster relief in Honduras, Guatemala, Ecuador, Belize, Colombia, and Bolivia, and particularly aimed at enabling communities who've been affected by natural disasters to respond and to restore their livelihoods as quickly as possible. Okay, I see my time is running out. I'm going to go through and just flag them. Land tenure, I hope will come up in these discussions. Participatory land delimitation and conflict resolution connected to land. We have the main land program in rural areas within the UN system. Conflict resolution associated with displacement, marginalization, and discrimination of indigenous peoples in rural areas. Gender, support to indigenous women's groups, empowerment of indigenous women, national policies for rural women that take into account cultural diversity, cultural indicators. There was a side event on this presented yesterday, and we have people in this room from indigenous communities who can speak a little bit about how they've used these cultural indicators for indigenous people's food and agri-ecosystems. And then communication for sustainable development, which I've already mentioned. Communication tools to enable indigenous peoples to put forward their own priorities and to improve their communication among themselves. And I'd like to turn the floor over to Eliana Rioja de Casanova for a moment to now present this from an indigenous people's perspective.
Thank you. We're grateful for this opportunity to talk about the communication experience we've been promoting with the FAO. I'd like to talk about the work we've been doing at the platform for communication of Indigenous Peoples Development in Bolivia. The aim of this communication platform is to be able to strengthen the links between our groups in Latin America to have some impact on public communication and development policies. We also want to have consensus building spaces so that we can have communication and development programs. This is a medium to exchange information among indigenous peoples in Latin America. It's also a mechanism and an instrument for participation that enables us to agree on a list of priorities and do capacity building and work towards self-determination and management of indigenous lands. In order to get functional communication on the agenda of Indigenous Peoples organizations, we organized a process of work. We organized international meetings where Indigenous organizations from Latin America met to analyze the importance of communication and the need to share knowledge on communication experience and also to disseminate that information, especially regarding the environment. These international meetings have helped us discuss important things, but also to make decisions about a communication strategy and to come up with a mechanism that allows us to do that. We took the decision to consolidate the platform for communication and development of Indigenous peoples in Latin America. We also carried out virtual regional meetings to discuss the issue, and that has helped us enrich the contents of the platform. We have participated in meetings and we've presented the platform once the decision was made to formalize it, and we have taken it to the Confederation of Indigenous Peoples of Bolivia, CIDOB, and that meant we were able to go to the 2006 Development Conference in Rome, where we became known, and that way communication has been included on the agenda of the international community and the permanent forum. We presented it at the 6th and 7th session of the permanent forum in order to gain recognition for the importance of the subject, communication and development. But based on the initiative of Indigenous peoples with the support of cooperation agencies. As a result of this impetus, we can say that we now have recognition from the permanent forum. We achieved this at the 7th session because in the final conclusions in paragraph 68, it was said that it was important to boost these platforms and to set up new platforms in other contents, in other continents such as Asia and Africa. I would also like to mention that one of the results of our work that's been ongoing since 2006 is this research into communication on climate change and Indigenous peoples. It deals with the communication experience and strategies of Indigenous peoples in Latin America, which proves that that communication does contribute towards suitable development, because we're able to show how we care for the environment and how we can avoid the impact of climate change, the consequences of which are unknown. This information has been disseminated by our communication platform and shared with other continents, and I think that can help to make it possible to get involved in better actions to mitigate climate change. This is still a draft version, but we have two colleagues here who can take your contact data, and once it's been published, hopefully in about 2 months, we can send you this information. We also have all of this material. We have videos that show what we do and the processes involved in our work.
I would like to conclude my very short presentation by mentioning what we believe should are the most pressing actions necessary. We need to give impetus to the platforms of indigenous peoples and those who are not represented in French-speaking Africa. For example, we need an area for consultation and for participation. We have identified that for cooperation, we need to deal with the ERA, trans-party organization, which is willing to support the French-speaking African platform. The FAO has supported the initiative, but it was the indigenous peoples' organizations of Latin America that have really backed us. Then it is important to realize that this same model could be used in French-speaking Africa because the project and process should be led by an indigenous grassroots organization with support of the cooperation agencies and NGOs. One of the conclusions of the forum is that we need to give a boost to the Asian platform so that we get support for it. I think it would be interesting for TIPTEVA, the TIPTEVA organization in Asia, to be one of the leaders of the program and to possibly lead the project in that region. Another pressing need is to create mechanisms for communication within the forum with cooperation agencies and indigenous groups. There needs to be some sort of mechanism for that. We also need a monitoring system with development indicators, one which will enable us to follow up the work we're doing and learn from the best practices. We also need to consolidate and expand platforms in other regions and extend alliances. That is important. Once the other platforms have been consolidated, we need an alliance among the different regions so that we can exchange knowledge and increase our organizational capacity. We also need to make sure that communication and self-determined development of indigenous peoples is high up on the international agenda. Thank you.
Yes. There's a considerable amount of research that's done on emerging issues affecting indigenous peoples' livelihoods to inform policy and international instruments. To give one example, there's been work done on indigenous peoples' food systems and its relationship to consumption patterns and community nutrition levels in 12 indigenous communities in 9 countries. And one of the key findings has been that local traditional food systems are much more nutritious and explain how different factors such as poverty and the influx of globalized food have a negative nutritional impact on indigenous communities. This will ultimately lead to health interventions. With regards to the policy level work, we operate on 2 levels. At the national level, in supporting the development of national policies and legal frameworks, and at the international level, in terms of instruments and treaties. I don't have time to go into it now, but I'll show just snapshot a few of them very quickly. But key principles in our work is about best practice, sustainability, participation, and cultural and biological diversity. The Code of Conduct on Responsible Fisheries, for which there's a document, documents at the front, the Right to Food Guidelines, where there's a specific focus on indigenous peoples. We have the International Treaty for Plant Genetic Resources on Food and Agriculture, the Plan of Action for Animal Genetic Resources, and the Interlaken Declaration on Animal Genetic Resources. All of these are actual tools that indigenous peoples can use to transform their rights into reality, to help governments design policies, strategies, and legislation that focus on vulnerable groups, including indigenous peoples. They can use them for advocacy, to represent the commitments of governments, and to show enable indigenous peoples to claim their rights, to increase the leverage of civil society to hold governments accountable for non-compliance, to facilitate monitoring and assessments of state performance, and to raise awareness about the important contributions that indigenous peoples have made. Now, I'd like to, in the final section of this presentation, just to focus a little bit more on what FEO can and cannot do, the nature of this organization. There are multiple approaches that the organization has used that are people-centered. One of the most important ones is the sustainable livelihoods approach, for which we have a brief also. And it's basically trying to build on local capacities, local capabilities, institutions, and knowledge, and trying to reflect that within national-level policies. It automatically takes into account the questions of changing priorities and needs of different people, and puts people at the heart of development efforts. And we believe we should really be strengthening the existing work that has already been done in this vein. Limitations. To be quite frank, until now, FAO's work with Indigenous peoples is not addressed in a systematic way. It tends to be sporadic. It tends to result from exogenous factors, government requests, specific government requests for support, project donors who have asked for this kind of support, the location of a project in a zone where Indigenous peoples predominate, or the personal knowledge and commitment of FAO staff. Another weakness is that much of the programs are very small scale in terms of money, small scale in terms of outreach, small scale in terms of time, and therefore small scale in terms of impact. The exceptions are multi-agency projects where we can engage with other agencies with different and complementary mandates to do much more concerted work over a longer period in response to the different needs that Indigenous peoples have. The Millennium Development Achievement Fund is really important in this respect. Now, other areas that we have to highlight in terms of limitations and the reasons for FAO's restrictions. First of all, FAO focuses primarily at the government level. It's a development organization that deals primarily at national and international levels. Its main client are governments. And therefore, the work we do has to come from governments, from government requests. The focus, we have a policy and normative focus. We also have a technical and field focus. And the work of the organization has to be complementary between these two areas. We're a specialized agency. We have, and as a specialized agency, have a separate governing body. So the General Assembly recommendations aren't automatically taken up. We have a separate governing body that consists of ministries of agriculture, forestry, fisheries, land. And decisions about what FAO works on has to go through that governing body. There are 191 member governments. We have a strong decentralized presence. But to work explicitly with Indigenous peoples, what we're working on now is trying to get eventually government buy-in in to support a policy and strategy relating to Indigenous peoples. When countries are not receptive, when governments are not receptive to Indigenous peoples, we are somewhat limited in what we can do. So we are restricted by what governments' requests actually are. What are some of the landmarks in our work? One of them is that a focal point position for Indigenous peoples within FAO was created in 2002. It now falls within the division that I helped to direct. Our focal point for the organization's work on Indigenous peoples is Regina Laub, who I have a pleasure to have with us today, and she is the person to get in touch with. We also are supported by an interdivisional working group of committed individuals who care about Indigenous issues and started working together informally, and the group is becoming more and more formal. and they coordinate and mainstream indigenous issues within the work of the organization. We're active within the interagency support group and in the UN Permanent Forum. And we're now working on a policy on indigenous peoples. In 2005, there were efforts to put together a comprehensive draft strategic framework for work, a systematic work for FAO with indigenous peoples. We have some people in the room here who participated in that work. And unfortunately, because of the FAO reform and reorganization, it stalled. But we've managed to revive it. And in September, largely because of the UN declaration, actually, in September 2007. And now we are working on putting together a policy. There's a draft available. We would strongly welcome comments from any of you on this policy of FAO's work with indigenous peoples. Eventually, we'd like to put together a strategy to put this into place and raise greater awareness of FAO staff at headquarters and the field level. There are some training sessions already underway, familiarizing our field offices about the UN Declaration, the UNDG guidelines, and the importance of indigenous peoples within FAO's mandate. And we can tell you more about that afterwards. Let me just say, there's a common misconception about FAO. FAO is not a funding organization. FAO is a technical, specialized agency. We cannot provide grants. We do not provide resources. All of our programs come at the request of governments for which regular program resources are then allocated. The only exception is when donors give extra budgetary resources for a particular cause. So our mandate is complementary with the World Food Program that gives food aid and EFAD that does investment programs in country and has grants. But FAO provides knowledge and technical assistance. That is our strength. The main ways for Indigenous peoples to engage with FAO is through the Civil Society Liaison Unit. Indigenous peoples representatives can participate in our governing bodies and have been very active in the World Committee for Food Security, including in the whole development of the Right to Food Guidelines. Indigenous peoples can be observers within FAO technical meetings. We have a policy and strategy for FAO engagement with civil society generally. And there are new opportunities because there's work underway now in revising the whole system of global governance on food security worldwide throughout the UN system. And we're hoping that there will be opportunities for greater engagement of civil society, including indigenous peoples, in this effort. In terms of the way forward, the FAO policy on indigenous peoples is really an important point. And again, please do, we would love you to provide inputs into this. We want to be engaged much more systematically with indigenous peoples in the future, and we're hoping to put together guidelines for programs and projects once the policy is approved, and to raise awareness within FAO about the declaration and the UN guidelines. And there's a huge need for continued internal advocacy on social inclusion throughout FAO's policies and operations. Thank you, and thank you for your patience in allowing us to go over a little bit.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Eve Crowley, Regina Loeb, and Eliana Rojas de Casanova. We would like now to give the floor to my distinguished colleagues, Elisa Kankimole and Tonya Gonella Frischner, to raise the questions. Tonya, I heard you are the one who will do it. Yes, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much to our colleagues from FAO for their very thorough explanation of what your agency does. And Ms. Crowley, we do appreciate your presentation, and Madam, for your presentation. I don't have my glasses on. I apologize. Madam Rojas, thank you very much. My colleague and I do have a few questions, and we do want to make a couple of comments. Although your report is quite candid regarding the challenges that FAO faces in its interaction with indigenous peoples, but very much appreciated, you did mention that it is not systematic, that your work with indigenous peoples is a bit sporadic, and the projects are small scale and therefore have a limited effect when it comes to indigenous peoples. But we hope and you hope that this dialogue will present some possible avenues for addressing these challenges. So with that, we would like to get to our questions because we do have a limited time, and our chair always likes to keep us on check. Referring to paragraph 15 of your report for this session, your intervention for adaptation and mitigation of climate change are mentioned. And you say, including, and I quote, integration of ecosystems and adaptation to climate change in the Colombian Massive. As another example of climate change, and I do come from and represent North America, I'd like to include disasters that do happen in North America. For example, wildfires in Southern California that are directly related to climate change and human usage that affect indigenous communities disproportionately. In fact, in and on the La Jolla Reservation, over 90% of the homes and buildings were lost completely. So this kind of thing happens in the north, and is it experienced on a terrible level. And what I would like to share with you is that experience that our people face, a situation in North America of the South in the north. And this is substantiated by developed country statistics. And needs attention from many parties and needs to be addressed by UN agencies. And my colleague and I wanted to share that with you and all other interested parties. Going to one of the questions that we wanted to get right into today had to do with what is FAO's role in reduced emissions from deforestation in developing countries? And how does FAO intend to apply the principles laid out in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the recommendations that the Permanent Forum has laid out in this area? And what are the actions that are being taken by FAO to ensure that indigenous peoples are not alienated and negatively affected by the RED program? Our sister and colleague, Madam Roja, mentioned earlier that there were communication initiatives. Jumping to that particular section, if you don't mind. Unfortunately, Ms. Crowley ran out of time earlier when it came to communication initiatives, but Madam Roja mentioned that that there was a very good program that was being run in by FAO in Bolivia, but not it did not seem that it was throughout all of Latin America, and we would like to know if the program was something that you were going to hopefully initiate throughout Latin America. We would think that that would be an excellent strategy. And regarding strategic partnerships for the future, and I'm going to step right into land and resources. And dear colleagues, land and resources, as you know, are critical issues for indigenous peoples. And when it comes to land and resources, it dovetails right into food security. It dovetails into traditional knowledge. And you began the presentation with an irrigation system that we're familiar with in Peru and in Bolivia. We would like to know, in these complementary concepts of food sovereignty, the right to food, food security, land and resources, what is the position of FAO? How are you applying the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? And how are the protection of our land and resources being applied, being protected, and of course the human rights of Indigenous peoples? I think with that, I am going to turn the questions over to my colleague, Madam Kunke. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Presidenta. Gracias.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the questions in Spanish and in English. As regards the policy which is being developed, we have serious concerns. However, we'd like to think a little beyond the adoption of policy. The adoption of the declaration, the guide, and then the necessary technical support to buttress this policy in states. We feel these instruments should be the basis for policy making. And in the context of the future, what is the challenge which the FAO faces in order to make indigenous issues mainstreamed across its mandate? What is your approach, and how can we as indigenous peoples help? How do our roles divide up in this context? And then perhaps the most challenging question, what is the challenge for the FAO in implementing free prior informed consent? Because it's been pointed out that once the declaration was adopted, a new process had to be launched, which is more focused to the indigenous peoples. So we need to think about these operational frameworks in future and see where we stand, each and every one of us. And then in this short period of time, it's almost 2 years since the adoption of the declaration, what sort of impact has it had on the conception of new programs once the declaration was adopted? Was there a change? Was there no change? Are we still waiting for policies to be developed for you to start work? Or are the examples which we've seen on the screen already the basis for the work to develop and to change the programs and projects which are being devised and perhaps already being implemented?
Respect.
And then I'd like to refer to paragraph 20, which refers to the studies which you've carried out with respect to the cases of different indigenous communities across the globe in terms of food security and food sovereignty. It's also on page 8. How has this influenced project design for you and for the indigenous peoples in this specific context? Has there been a change, or has it just been left on paper, which is just going to be archived in the FAO? And also, have you responded to the demands of the indigenous people? Have the indigenous people truly participated, not just in providing information, but in the entire process? And has the outcome been one of true respect for the indigenous peoples? And lastly, I'd like to move to the operational dimension of the FAO's work. As indigenous peoples, we've always heard that there's a dearth of capacity. There's concern within the United Nations agencies in this regard. But I'd like to know how many indigenous people are on staff in the FAO, if there are any. And if not, over the last 2 years, have there been consultants, at least, who are specialists on indigenous issues or indigenous professionals who've been brought on board in the definition and execution of projects? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tonya Gunella-Frischner and Elisa Kankimolo. We have run out of time, but we still have another hour after when we come back at 3 o'clock. No? So we will come back here at 3 o'clock to continue the dialogue with FAO. And then after that, we will have the dialogue with the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. So let me thank the dear colleagues from FAO for their presentation, Eve Crowley, Regina Loeb, and Ileana, and also the colleagues for raising the questions. And we will come back here after we have some lunch to again continue with the discussions. Thank you very much, and we'll see you at 3 o'clock in this same room. Does our secretary have any announcements? No, there are no announcements, so this meeting is adjourned. Okay.
Bonjour, ça va? Ça va, ma chère?
Oui, Willy, ça va.
I will invite all speakers, please take your seat. Welcome everybody. We will start this parallel event. I will talk in Spanish. The translation is working? Please, may I ask?
Yes.
Okay. Todo está bien.
Everything is working. Everything. Everyone can hear. Very well. The Assembly of First Nations Inuit Papilit Kanatani are sponsoring this side event, which is termed a global initiative, Stop Tuberculosis in Indigenous Peoples, for our children, for our communities, and for our future. We have five persons who will be with us here this afternoon. Mark Husel from the International Union Against TB and Pulmonary Diseases. We have a distinguished colleague, Wilton Littlechild, who is the Regional Chief of Alberta of the Assembly of First Nations. Mrs. Gillian Mann, World Alliance, Stop Tuberculosis. My very dear colleague, Lillian, from the Permanent Council of the United Nations on Indigenous Issues, Africa. My co-country person from Bolivia, Nisa Delgado, you are most welcome. And myself, All of us will be sponsoring and leading this meeting. I will call on Mark, our guest. You have the floor.
Can we hear? Okay. Okay. Let me start by thanking the organizers of this session for inviting me to be a part of this panel. I represent the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. It's my organization's vision to bring forward effective health solutions to improve lung health among the poor of the world. The Union, which is our more popular name, has been at work fighting TB and other lung health problems since 1920. And in doing so, we work with the United Nations, World Health Organization, Ministries of Health, civil society, donors, and others to achieve our goal. I applaud the Permanent Forum's commitment to address the burden of TB among indigenous people, as well as the launch of the Global Indigenous Stop TB Strategic Plan. Today, my charge is to briefly go over the burden of tuberculosis worldwide. You'll notice in my comments that I won't go into too much detail about the burden of tuberculosis among indigenous people, mainly because the picture has not been fully painted. We lack good information about tuberculosis in your populations. We also have a number of other panelists here who will provide some excellent points, so I want to allocate enough time to them as well, so I'll do this very quickly. What I will do is describe the global burden of TB based on the most recent statistics available from WHO and the global community in order to set the stage for further remarks by this panel. Now, for those of you who don't know much about tuberculosis, it is an ancient disease. It's been around with us for thousands of years. It's a classical disease that today is rooted in poverty and other social determinants of health, such as access to health care, overcrowded living conditions, poor nutrition, smoking, pollution, and so on. It's also closely tied to another one of the developing world's most challenging health issues, HIV/AIDS. TB is caused by an airborne bacteria that are transmitted from an infectious person to another person via the air through coughing and close sustained contact. TB affects mainly the lungs, but TB can develop in different locations within the body, including other organs. If I can just go back to the second slide. I'm sorry, I forgot about the slides. Here are some key figures for TB globally. 2 billion people in our world actually carry the bacteria that causes active TB disease. In tuberculosis, we have two stages. We have infection and disease. So 2 billion, roughly a third of the world's population, have actually been exposed to somebody with active TB disease and have been infected by the TB bacteria. That doesn't mean, however, that they have active TB disease. Only about 10% on average of people around the world who carry the bacteria in their body will ever develop active TB disease. However, among HIV-infected populations and people who have other immunocompromising conditions, the chance of developing TB disease, particularly in the lung and other parts of the body, increases considerably. It's also important to remember that TB disease that is sensitive to our best drugs can be cured in most cases. Treatment is based usually on four drugs. It's a combination therapy, and it costs usually, in most developing settings, less than $20 for cure. However, if drug-resistant TB is present, treatment is expensive, it can take very much longer, and it can be very toxic and hard to manage. If left untreated, two-thirds of people with TB will die, usually after they have infected many others, which continues the cycle of infection worldwide. Next slide, please. Thank you. This slide contains all of the essential numbers that you need to understand the burden of tuberculosis globally. You'll notice they are rather large numbers, and this is something that the global community is now, through a Stop TB partnership, trying to confront, which I'll speak to in a few slides. These numbers are compiled by WHO. You'll notice that they're called global TB estimates, and the reason we call them estimates is that we use a number of different strategies to try to quantify the burden of TB around the world. One are prevalence surveys in countries, like this one, in other countries, and so on. Two are actual case reports that WHO collects from countries, member nations of the United Nations. And then three We also have surveys that we do amongst specific populations. Now, WHO estimates that worldwide in 2007, over 9 million TB cases occurred, and of those, roughly 4 million were infectious. TB can be in the lungs. Normally, it's predominantly in disease of the lungs, but it can be elsewhere. And it's normally only people who have active TB, pulmonary TB in the lungs, who are infectious. WHO estimates that 1.65 million people died of TB in 2007, which means roughly 4,500 people every day. WHO also estimates that based on surveys conducted in over 110 settings in the last decade, that nearly 500,000 cases are multi-drug resistant, and 150,000 of these are fatal cases. Extremely drug-resistant TB, or XDR-TB, as you may have heard in the news recently worldwide, are TB cases which are resistant to all of our first-line and second-line drugs, which are our reserve drugs, and the estimated number of XDR cases is about 50,000 in 2007, the majority of which are untreatable. Finally, well over 1 million of the 9 million cases are linked with HIV/AIDS, or about 15% of total cases. In Africa, on average, this percentage of co-infection among TB patients with HIV is very much higher, up to 50% in some countries. So TB in Africa is the AIDS-defining illness that we're addressing. In the rest of the world, however, the vast majority of TB cases are not due to HIV. Next slide, please. This slide indicates the incidence of TB, or the occurrence of new TB cases in the year 2007, and the incident rate is simply the number of cases per 100,000 population, and it's presented here by countries around the world. You'll notice the countries that are in the darker colors, the dark reds, the bright reds, those are the countries that have the highest incident rate, or more cases per 100,000 population than others. Certainly, the developing world features higher rates of TB on average, but I do wish to stress that some population groups within the lower rate countries, such as the United States and Canada, still have significantly high rates of TB in certain populations, including indigenous populations. If you can roll the next. And the pie chart that just popped up on the screen just indicates the distribution of incident cases or new cases of TB in 2007. And you can see that between Southeast Asia, the Western Pacific, and Africa, the lion's share of cases are born. However, I would reiterate the fact that for those of you from the Americas or the Eastern Mediterranean or even Europe, there are still very high rates of TB in certain populations, including indigenous populations in many places. Next slide, please. Beyond the numbers is the toll of tuberculosis, which I think we need to constantly remember. This is one of my favorite quotes from one of the earliest proceedings of the Stop TB partnership back in 2000. Essentially, the toll of TB is on communities, on families, on villages, on economic systems, and on countries. TB in many developing settings attacks not just marginalized populations, but also teachers and educators, accountants, and so on. So we have to remember that like HIV/AIDS, diseases like TB in many countries greatly impact national manufacturing capacity, agricultural production, school attendance, and civilian and military services. TB also remains a very highly stigmatized disease. So systems for the diagnosis, treatment, and cure, although they're effective, they need to be improved, but they're challenging in their current state for many patients, and they're not optimal in terms of their efficiency. So what do we know about TB disease among indigenous people? Unfortunately, we have incomplete surveillance and limited engagement of communities. Thus, I think this underscores the need for this initiative that brings you all together today. The picture of the burden of TB among the indigenous worldwide is incomplete. However, in many indigenous communities, the key ingredients for higher rates of TB are present. So an indigenous Stop TB strategy should focus on increasing the awareness and surveillance, or the definition of the epidemic, or the burden of TB globally among the indigenous populations of the world. Next slide. You know, there are many partnerships around the world that address health issues or economic issues. I would say that the Stop TB partnership, which is endorsed by WHO, the Secretariat is actually hosted by WHO, but it numbers now over 450 active participating organizations and groups. The Stop TB partnership is a winning partnership. So I would encourage this forum and all of the members in this forum to actively consider engaging within the Stop TB partnership. The UN Millennium Development Goals actually addresses tuberculosis in target goal number 6, and the Stop TB partnership has built even more aggressive goals, here seen on the slide below, in terms of reducing TB prevalence and deaths and actually eliminating TB from the world by 2050. So this is a very strong partnership around the world that's rooted in the United Nations and the World Health Organization, but is populated by groups like yours who are very interested in addressing TB as a social and a health issue. The Stop TB strategy is the cornerstone strategy for the Stop TB partnership. I won't go into it in detail, but I think you can access this strategy at stoptb.org. And you'll notice that it's a very well-defined strategy. The interventions that the strategy supports are all science-based, and the greatest scientific minds in the world have been brought together to support and to implement this strategy. I encourage you to get to know the Stop TB strategy. Lastly, as you become more knowledgeable and active in the fight against TB among your people, you'll find that in global TB control, there's a long tradition of measuring and evaluating what we do. That, I think, also separates us from other partnerships. We're very, very focused in on success and on reducing the amount of TB among indigenous populations as well as other populations around the world. If you want to become more involved in a global health movement that's well evaluated, I think the Stop TB partnership is the one you should choose. Here you see the latest outcomes, for example, of the global movement to stop TB. Our two key indices, our measuring sticks, are here on the left, the estimated number of cases that we've detected. Sputum smear positive cases are people who are infectious and can transmit to others. And on the right, once we detect people with TB, how well we cure them, bring them to treatment, and our success rates for cure. You'll notice that we're doing quite well. Our global target on the